Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
The evil bitch that is coronavirus may still be raging outside, but Corolla Drinks is hard at work with another month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This month includes a Beard Bro beard shaping tool to tame that unruly corona facial hair, and a Chew face mask so you can silently protest how f***ing stupid all of this is. A 6-foot premium beer bong by beerbong.com so you can slug back a few cold, endless rants when the world officially opens up again. And of course, a bottle of your choice. We know times are tough, but we at Corolla Drinks are here to remind you to take a breath, have a drink, and wait for all this shit to be over. Mahalo.
All right. Well, a good long Reasonable Doubt episode planned for you guys today. There's a person that Mark Garagos defended many years ago, or represented many years ago, who's in my mind much worse than Scott Peterson.
Oh, but, yeah.
So those of you who hate Mark for Scott Peterson or maybe Michael Jackson or whatever, oh, he runs. This is a deeper cut than that. So that'll come up at some point today. We'll go through that. And Flynn as well. First, I'll tell you about Tommy John. Yeah, the secret to staying sweat-free this summer. Tommy John, summer-ready, ultra-breathable underwear and bras, cool cotton underwear for men and women. It's like having your own body-worn AC factory right on top of you. They're made of premium natural. I'll tell you my story in a minute. Premium natural Pima cotton, and it's has enhanced airflow and evaporates sweat faster. I wear them every single night. Every night about, it's about 9:30. I row on that machine for half an hour. I get soaked with sweat. I just walk around my house and I just dry off because I'm wearing the tees and I'm wearing the underpants. They have polos and tees and loungewear that's super soft as well. It's the best pair you'll ever wear. Or it's free, guarantee. Right, Gary?
That's right. For a limited time, go to TommyJohn.com/Adam and get 20% off site-wide. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 20% off site-wide. TommyJohn.com/Adam. See site for details.
This is Corolla Digital. This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagos and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on. Mandate, get on. Welcome to the best hour in the universe. It's Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla. It's Mark Garagos in his office in downtown.
In the office downtown, finishing up a mediation as we speak. And I told the judge, Your Honor, I got to talk to Adam. And she said that she told me she's a huge fan of yours. So you should know that even the federal judiciary appreciates the former federal prosecutor and Rear Admiral Adam Carolla.
What is going on in your world, in the world at large, news? What's on your mind?
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting, because we've covered this case somewhat, is the Flynn decision came out yesterday, I think, 2-1, which shows you, I'm going to do a critique of my own prognostication. Originally, when we talked on this show, I thought it would be 2-1 before I listened to the arguments. And I think I had mentioned that to you, based on who was appointed, basically when you take what's called an interlocutory writ in the circuit court in the federal, you get three randomly assigned judges. And you can take a look at these judges and you can sometimes prognosticate. It's lawyers like to do that. And I had originally prognosticated 2-1. And then I listened to the oral arguments that they had streamed live, And Gary and I did a update, right, Gary?
That's absolutely right. As we often like to do when things break and maybe Adam's on the road or something like that.
Yeah, I thought based on the oral arguments that they were going to press pause and say, let the judge, in this case, Emmett Sullivan, do the hearing and then decide what to do after that. There was no reason to get involved at this point, that if they could kind of put it off, that they wouldn't want to do an interlocutory order, meaning kind of before the proceedings had ended. Au contraire, the Trump-appointed district or circuit court judge was joined by another Republican appointee, and in a 2-1 dissent over the Barack Obama appointee, they ordered that Emmett Sullivan dismiss Flynn's case. And so that's where it stands right now. But once again, I'm going to say this may not be the end of that, because Judge Sullivan, who hired his own counsel to argue the case, there's still the possibility that he may ask that the entire panel of the circuit hear this. And he's got a shot at that, because when you have a dissent, the dissenter sometimes is aiming for what's called an in-bank review. And so that may be where we're at. But I want to hear Adam's usual insightful, slightly out of the legal character reaction to this.
You know, I haven't been, you know, all the news has kind of been on COVID-19 and rioters and, you know, defund the police and stuff. So I haven't gotten too many updates on this. I have a general rule, which is I'm not interested in non-violent people being incarcerated and in general, overall. Now, I get the part where you could be a Benedict Arnold and, you know, you could be tried for treason. And, you know, obviously you taking a bunch of military secrets and giving it to China is a nonviolent crime, but it could cause violence. You know what I mean? Like it could cause a war. Right. So if you can build a bridge to violence or you're participating in violence, I want you behind bars. The people, the scariest people in society, and this goes for Martha Stewart as well, you know? And I always think this way about Wesley Snipes and tax evaders and stuff. Like, okay, you didn't put your hands on anybody, but you cheated the government out of some money. Let's not put you in a cage. Let's have you work this debt off. And
right, so, we've talked about that. I'd rather have an earner, and I've never understood that. Rather than somebody who's sucking more resources out of society, I'd rather have them pay society.
Right. And I feel this way about Flynn. I think I feel this way about Dinesh D'Souza. Like, everyone hates Dinesh D'Souza. He's a felon. He's a felon because of some campaign.
Or was. Didn't Trump pardon him?
Oh, I don't know.
I think Trump pardoned him, and I think Ben Brofman represented him at one point.
I don't know. I didn't hear if Trump, or maybe Trump did pardon him. The point is I, in general, don't like the government incarcerating people for sort of process crimes, you know, that have to do with the IRS or that have to do with phone calls or you know, campaign contributions, you know what I mean? Like, I don't like the idea that the government says, hey, we made a rule, and that rule is you couldn't declare your home office as a home office if you have more than two kids and you live in a two-bedroom apartment, then that can't be your home office, and you claim it as a home office, and at some point you end up in jail. I don't like that, and I don't like the Dinesh D'Souza stuff, where it's like, we said you could only give a maximum of $10,000 to each candidate. You gave $10,000 to two candidates, and now you got to go someplace. I don't like that.
I agree with you all.
But I feel the same way about the young black kid selling a joint too. I'm across the bar on incarcerating those who are involved with crimes that aren't either directly linked to violence or I could build a bridge to violence. Like, I said giving away very sensitive, you know, military secrets or something like that. And I don't even know what Flynn's, I don't know what his real charge was. What was?
Well, they, it's interesting. I was just going to say as an aside, when you said you feel the same way about black kids who were selling a joint. I mean, there used to be the son of the former attorney general of California, who was Evel Younger. His son, Eric, who's a superior court judge, was many years ago in Pasadena. He used to call these possession of crack cocaine cases the parking ticket of superior court. It used to drive him crazy that he was presiding over this kind of endless revolving door of those cases. In Flynn's case, the reason it's so frustrating, I think, for the criminal defense bar is that the case was, to my mind, manufactured in the first place. It was a crime that you just hate to see the government, given all of the facts, and I know people could disagree depending on your political stripes, but for speaking as a criminal defense lawyer, this is a crime that shouldn't have been, I mean, it should have been clearly investigated. I mean, if they have the probable cause, they don't even need that to believe that there's something untoward happening. But when you look at the facts, it just did not warrant the indictment. It certainly didn't warrant this guy pleading guilty once or twice and destroying a career that up until then appeared to be one that was great. What's galling about the whole thing is that the Department of Justice, presumably, because as Judge Gleason, who was appointed by Judge Sullivan, found that the reasons they gave for dismissing it were, I think Judge Gleason may have used the term contrived. But if you were to take some independent party, and I can give you all of my cases that I laundry list, and had them look at how ridiculous some of these things are and what the U.S. attorneys do in many instances that by comparison to Flynn, you wouldn't find it. If you're going to use that standard, then use it across the board. Just don't do it for somebody who happens to be a crony of Trump. Just because the president's got a megaphone, I don't think that somebody should get more justice. They shouldn't. It's what I used to say about celebrities. When people say, oh, they get a special treatment, I said, God save the celebrity from the special treatment. You don't want that kind of treatment. You want the way it normally happens. Here, it's almost the opposite. Because you're affiliated with Trump, you do get your head kicked in an extra special way. And only because he starts complaining vociferously, and only because you've got Barr who's doing his dirty work, are you getting a situation where this thing is now at a point where a circuit court is writing an unbelievable order? I mean, that order is unreal. All Judge Sullivan had done is say, I want to have a hearing. The code section of Rule 48 says upon leave of the court was going to have the hearing. They're saying, no, you don't even get to have the hearing. We're going to read that right out of the statute. So it's an unbelievable dispensing of justice that I only wished happened across the board.
I don't like it. It scares me a little when FBI guys are going, well, I don't think there's a lot of there, but what are we looking to get on this guy? You know, what do we want to do?
Exactly.
Like that.
Exactly.
I don't want our government agencies working that way.
But that's exactly what the federal bureaucracy does. I mean, the irony of all of this and why I personally get so kind of twisted into contortions about what's happening in the country right now is so much of what Trump and those his ilk complain about, I agree wholeheartedly with. The problem, I mean, wholeheartedly, and I've been screaming about it. I wrote a book about it 7 years ago, talking about how the system is broken. I agree with all of that. But it's unfair when it's only exposed for the small people who happen to be in the inner circle. That gives me the same kind of angst and heartburn that it should give them. It should be universal.
I was listening to some news the other day. They were talking about the two cops in Minnesota that shot the man with the taser, and they said, you know,
Atlanta?
We're bringing Atlanta. Sorry. Wrong riot.
Rashad Brooks, right.
Right. And so they got the one cop who squeezed the trigger, and I get why they're bringing charges against him, and then they're bringing charges against his partner. I think it was maybe aggravated assault or something. And I said, well, wait a minute. That guy just got his ass kicked in the parking lot of a Wendy's. Like, where does that come in? And then I think Gina said, well, it's because he put his foot on him when he was down, I think. And I thought, oh, is that why he's being charged? I don't know why there are any charges against the second officer, but what did he do, and then how do they prove that?
Let me tell you, I've got strong opinions on this as well. There's a recent case in New York, and for the first time in a long time, and when I say recent, within the last 7 or 10 days, the you saw one cop obviously exerting way too much force for what it was. I actually think I saw another cop trying to stop him, which is what you would want. You want to make it part of what police reform should be, is you do not want this kind of thin blue line, whatever you want to call it, blue wall of silence. There's a million different names. You want to encourage that. You do not want to encourage I don't want to encourage snitches, but at the same time, I don't want cover-ups. I want somebody who's going to solve the problem. The problem, be careful what you wish for in Atlanta, is if the other cop, and maybe they know something I don't, but the other cop apparently gave a statement, was cooperative in the sense that he told it like it was, they indict him. From the video that I've seen, and by the way, we're talking, I don't know all of the facts of this case. I don't have anything more than anybody else does. I watched the video like you did, Adam. But if you watch the video, it does not appear that he did anything untoward. Certainly does not appear that he's done anything criminal. Somebody can tweet at us and educate us, but I didn't see anything. And frankly, the problem they've got is the way the law is written, the way the jury instructions are written, when that guy turns around, points the taser and shoots and you see the flash, the jury instructions are going to basically instruct the jury to that they must find a reasonable doubt as to that officer as to self-defense. The idea that you're now going to drag the other officer along, when I don't think that there is a sufficient basis. Remember, prosecutors got to believe, if I'm going to file criminal charges, I believe beyond a reasonable doubt I can convict this guy. I don't see a basis for that. I don't see how he's got a good faith basis for that.
Well, I'm looking at what Gary wrote on the screen. The non-shooter, that was Officer Bronson, is charged with aggravated assault and 2 counts of violation of oath for standing on his shoulder. So I guess he showed up and stood on the guy's shoulders or held him down or did whatever. And then the
other violation of oath was for not providing timely medical service.
Oh, okay.
I can see that. I can see that. If the guy, because I've had that case within the last 36 hours. If somebody's lying on the ground, even if you shot him, if somebody is waving their hands and saying, help me, and you don't do anything and let him bleed out, that's not appropriate.
Well, how about the violation of oath of letting a citizen take his taser from him? I feel like that's the biggest violation. Like, if I'm swearing you in, you got to swear to always have your taser and never let somebody take it from you. That's a violation in my world. But
by the way, yes. What about a products liability case? If the taser is removed, you know, when I'm on the treadmill and I've got that little key that with the red button, and if I move far away, it disables the machine. Wouldn't you think you'd have the same thing on the taser?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, for sure. I mean, they have guns that work that way, where they can recognize your hand or your fingerprint or whatever the technology is, a chip in it
or something. There's several different. There's ones that have fingerprints. There's one where it connects to a watch, and if it's not in the hand that watch is on.
Oh, right. Now, to me, the liability with the taser should be you shouldn't be able to hand that to a lay person and have them run full speed and fire it at somebody. There should be, you know, when you look at you look at using a chop saw, one of my chop saws. You have to push a button in and pull the trigger. Like, there's two things you have to do on many tools, many power tools. There's like a simultaneous thing you need to do for safety. And you couldn't just, a layperson couldn't just grab my chop saw and know how it worked. Yes.
Yes, and on all of the devices for my one-year-old child.
Right.
They all have a double action so that the kid can't actually turn it on. It's very basic.
Can I make a suggestion?
I just bought a steamer. I just bought a steamer, like a tile grout steamer, and it's like you have to push one thing up and pull the other thing in. I mean, anyone who's ever handled anything with a blade on it and a motor attached to it knows there's a couple moves you have to do. So the liability with the taser might be that there's nothing to do but pull the trigger and anyone could pull it. Yes, go ahead, Mark.
So I'm going to make the argument when people complain about lawyers and complain about lawsuits. I think the only reason that guns aren't safer is because there's the artificial shield of liability against gun makers. I think just like if your power tool is designed in such a way that it could injure somebody, that you can sue them. I can sue the manufacturer. They don't get the power. Somebody who makes a saw and it's designed in a way that could cause an injury, they don't get immunities for that. They have to defend themselves. Gun manufacturers, same thing. You started suing, if you stripped them of their liability and allowed you to sue them, I think you would rapidly either see safer guns or they would stop selling them so willy-nilly because of the potential liability.
Oh, I agree.
And God forbid I say that, but you know, it's so interesting to me that your brain went there. The idea that your skill saw or your, what do you call it, chop saw, has
miter saw. Yeah, the worst example is back in the day. It's in my movie, The Hammer. A belt sander, you can pull the trigger on, put the plunger down, and lock it on when it's not plugged in. And so when you go to plug it in, it just goes. And routers are very dangerous. And routers have a squeeze kind of progressive trigger on them now. They used to just have a toggle switch on top of them. And so it's like if they were unplugged or put away or whatever and they were turned on, but you didn't know it, you just went to go plug it in, it just fired, which is
right.
Scary.
And I'm going to speculate that the reason you could probably track the reason for those innovations to lawsuits that were filed because of the problems that happened before. I'm not saying you have to make everything idiot proof, but you should at least make it safer or, you know, for the same reason that you'd want somebody to be trained and know what they're doing with your tools is the same reason that I would want better training for the cops. Or, as I've argued for years, I don't understand why prosecutors and cops don't have to have a battery of psychological testing. I mean, cops actually, I think, in a lot of ways, have more psychological testing and prerequisites than prosecutors do. And well, that, to me, makes absolutely no sense.
Let's something that's never come up, but now it's coming up in my mind, which is so much of these killings are predicated on I was wrestling with the man. And look, let's be honest. A lot of these guys are big, strong, you know, ex-jocks and stuff like that. And now the cops are wrestling with them, you know. And then they go, I was in fear that he'd take my gun. I was in fear that he would take my gun. And it's a difficult thing to disprove. You know, fear is tough to disprove. In the heat of battle, who knows if this person was. Now, I don't think they're trying to take their gun. In 9 times out of 10, but 10 times out of 10, that'll work for an argument. You know what I mean? I was in fear. Once he got my gun, then he was going to kill me. Why don't cops all have the guns that correspond with their wristwatch or that have the chip in them that reads their thumbprint or their fingerprint? Like, why isn't every taser and every cop? Because 8 out of 10 of these arguments is we struggled. I feared he was going to take my gun. What if we just remove that as your argument? Your gun is not operable by anyone but you.
This is anecdotal. I haven't ever seen any studies on it. I'm sure there are studies on it. But in 80% of the cases that I get where there are people, where we represent families of people who have been killed by the police, almost, I would say 70-80%. The cop is a former Afghani or Iraqi war vet, and in many cases has PTSD as diagnosed in the military or in a prior police agency they work for. And in many of the cases, our client's loved one who is now deceased has some issue with mental illness. There is some struggle with mental illness. I mean, it's a recurring theme. I ask those two questions for of almost every case. What's the cop's background? What's the client's background or the deceased background? And you'd be shocked, I think, maybe not shocked, you wouldn't be, but others would, as to the how often those questions are answered with those two answers. So if that's the case, if you know that somebody, that in a large proportion of these, somebody's got PTSD who's got the gun, then why not try to prevent that, kind of the hair trigger, as the old expression goes, and have the technology involved to save them from doing that? In a million different ways, as you just suggested. Why not? What's the downside?
In the Atlanta case, the cop's going to say, if he'd hit me with the taser, I could have been incapacitated momentarily long enough for him to get my gun.
Correct. Right. Exactly where they're going to go. And if he doesn't say it, the cop's union, the police union, will hire an expert who will testify that is precisely the parade of horribles that could have happened, and you can't second guess it because they're in real time and there's, you know, and the adrenaline's going. That's going to be the police practices expert's testimony.
Right. But if you had a gun that couldn't be operated by anybody except for the officer, then it would tend to get rid of that. Yes, Gary.
The argument that I have seen from those on the other side of it is that you can't risk the technology failing. I'm not saying I subscribe to that. I'm saying that the NRA, the reason certain groups don't like that kind of technology is they say that will fail.
At a certain point, it becomes like autopilot. Like, at a certain point, the technology, you know, I was just talking to someone about the brand new Honda Jet, you know, and it says the autopilot is so good on that plane, the computer's so good, you could imagine, that you don't need a co-pilot. Because at some point, the autopilot, the technology actually gets better than the human being, because most accidents are caused by human error, not catastrophic mechanical error. So at a certain point, more people are shot by mistake, or the cop shoots his partner, or shoots himself, or whatever. You know, it outweighs the technologies. Actually, at a certain point, outweighs the human being. Who says humans are flawless?
Yeah, except if you've ever flown in a private jet, and I have, and you only have one pilot, it's very difficult to take a nap. I don't care what anybody says. I've been there. I've done it a zillion times. It's entirely, and especially if the guy is our age, you're thinking, okay, he looked like he's in pretty good shape, but you know, I didn't give him an EKG before he got on.
I don't like it when they have two pilots and they on the private jet. First world problems with Adam Carolla and Mark Garagos. We'll be back after
this. That's exactly right.
I don't like it when the co-pilot gets dispatched to hand out snacks. I don't like at some point they get to cruising altitude and they tell the co-pilot, yeah, go get the wicker basket with the saltines in it and ask him if he wants another IPA. And I'm like, no, go up front. You worry about the plane. I'll deal with the snacks back here. All right, let me hit.
Speaking of which, yes. You're going to get it? Go.
Method Men. That's right. Heard us talking about them last week. Fresh approach to grooming. Staying clean and fresh should be fuss-free. This stuff is good. They gave it to everyone here, and everyone here uses it religiously. Body washes are great. They smell fantastic. Everything is nature-inspired, the fragrances, and they're plant-based, and they lather up thick and clean. I have the Sea Surf, which is awesome smelling, and I also have the cedar cypress deodorant that I use. It's all natural. It doesn't have aluminum in it. The stuff is packaged great. It smells great. It doesn't smell like deodorant. Like, it doesn't smell like the fat guy at the gym. It's great stuff.
Which one do you use?
Sea Surf.
That's what I use too. And I like the smell, and my wife likes the smell, which usually it's one or the other, but we both are down.
Right.
So,
Sea Surf. Okay.
Yeah. Beautiful. 15% off with the code DOUBT when you buy online at methodmen.com. That's methodmen.com. And use DOUBT. Get the 15% off. You're going to love this stuff. So, along with body cams, we should get the gun recognition thing going. Sorry, go ahead.
I couldn't agree more. I don't get it. I always think of the treadmill, and as I mentioned, and it makes absolutely no sense to me. So there's two other things that I wanted to see. You tell me what you'd rather talk about, because I'd like to hear your opinion on both. One is the firing of Jeff Berman, who is the U.S. attorney in charge of the Southern District. The second one is, as we're taping this, I understand Gary may have more breaking news, that Texas and Florida are closing back down. Both of those are topics we've covered before. And the latter, I'd love to hear what you got, what your statement is on Florida and Texas closing back down.
Well, I was just talking to Dr. Drew about this on the way in, because I wanted to always, have that reference point. They're talking
so good,
about.
Because I would have.
Yeah.
That's exactly why I asked you. I figured you'd be on with Drew. You guys have had more off the air conversations since COVID than in the last 10 years, right?
Absolutely. He's talking about, there's spikes and there's cases and then there's fatalities, So for me, I like to keep my sort of eye on the prize, which is the fatality part, and the hospitals being overwhelmed, So if the hospitals aren't overwhelmed and the fatalities are on the decline, then I'm not inclined to embrace another shutdown. And we don't know how much of it is political and how much of it is, for public safety. The thing that Drew was saying is that younger people are getting it, but younger people aren't being affected by it. So, I'm still basically positive, sort of pardon the pun, about the whole thing. My whole thing was open stuff up, get people out there, get strong people exposed to it, get the herd immunity, turn the page, and get on with our life. And my problem also is I never know, now that I watch CNN, I just never know what they're reporting, because I don't know if their plan is, well, now that the rioting and the race relations stuff has calmed down a little, it's time to get back up, time to pick up that baton again and get going with the COVID-19. I don't know. I'm not saying that stuff isn't happening. I just know that when they start doing data and they start explaining, death rates, but they don't factor in the population and against the number and start using statistics, then I start to wonder how accurate or how intentionally inaccurate their model is. So I don't.
And it's interesting you say that, because right before I got in the air, I was on with, I won't say which case, but I was on with the opposing counsel, a government lawyer, and we were talking about filing a restraining order because we can't find this particular client, I'll talk about it in generalities, is not allowed to do his particular business, even though every component of the business, when you break it down, is allowed. So you can go into a restaurant or a bar, but this guy can't put on an event. You can do a church ceremony, but this guy can't put on his related cultural event. And you realize that what it is that nobody has thought it through. Nobody on the state level has gone through exactly the kind of guidance, so to speak, that you want. Then you get things like this mask order, and the mask order, which is, I have looked and I can't seem to find a basis upon which you can criminalize this, the governor's emergency declaration that everybody's got to wear masks. And as we speak, yesterday, there was a case decided where the Court of Appeals said you can't just violate what I've been complaining about for about a month on the air. You can't violate or have a decree that speedy trial never happens based on some amorphous declaration of emergency. Finally, the Court of Appeal ruled that. Today, somebody just approached the office, and I'm thinking about doing this case pro bono. Tell me what you think of this. I've got a lawyer who's got a client. He's in the middle of jury selection, and he's complaining because the judge is making everybody, all the jurors, wear masks. So you can't, while you're supposed to select the jury, the jurors are masked. You can't see their expressions or anything else. And the judge has said, okay, I'll give you time to take a writ on this. But to me, that makes no sense. What are you going to do? You're going to say, okay, judge, I want my speedy trial, and I'm in jail. Where, by the way, we also have an epidemic of the virus. And if I go forward on my trial, I've got to give up my right and my lawyer and to be effective assisting me to have to pick a jury when the potential jurors are masked. It's almost like doing comedy to a laugh track as opposed to a live audience, if you know what I mean. It doesn't perfectly work, but
yeah, it's a good analogy. Biden just came out and said if he's elected, he'll use federal power to require masks. Boy, this government's getting big fast, man.
Well, it's interesting how there was a letter yesterday that was signed on by a lot of people that had talked about sacrificing your liberties in other countries under the guise of Corona declarations. And I kept thinking to myself as I'm reading this letter, Gary can probably find it. By the way, hello, why do we have to go to other countries? It's happening here. I'm dealing with it every single day. And for some reason, nobody is talking about it. And by the way, the thing you just talked about that Drew had told you, I was diving into the data today in preparation for filing this restraining order. It does appear in California, at least, I'm not speaking nationally, but in California, there isn't a compelling argument, and I've got two experts on this, that we're seeing a surge in the
fatalities
that you can attribute to fatalities or anything else. What you're seeing a surge in, the best you can say is that as we are increasing testing, we're increasing the positive cases, but not necessarily. You're not seeing a rise in, like, out of every 100,000 tests or 10,000 tests, you're not seeing a rise in the percentage. So that tends to support the idea that we have more tests, and I don't want to sound like Trump, but we're testing more, we're getting more numbers.
Well, look, here's the dealio. Nobody said society didn't, there's no such thing as a society that doesn't have some element of risk involved. It's a society, you know what I mean? It's a society that's going to be free, and a certain amount of people are going to get hit by cars, and there's a certain amount of people are going to get hurt riding mass transit, and it's woven into our agreement to have a society. So my thing is if the hospitals are overwhelmed, then that's an issue. And if they don't have ICU beds, then that's an issue. And if the death rate goes up significantly, then that's an issue. You getting a positive test is part and parcel with running a society. Here's how society works. People go outside, they patronize businesses and stores and ball games, they have social interactions, they go to work with coworkers, and there's a good chance that whatever the flu or COVID-19 is going to be spread. But shutting it down because of that is you basically saying, I'm ignoring the rules of society. The rules of society are, if you're going to live in a free society, then X amount of negative stuff is going to happen. You let people, I know it's a dumb analogy that everyone overuses, but you make the speed limit 75, certain people are going to get in accidents and hurt, or worse, fatalities, but overall, It's a society. That's how it runs.
And by the way, they do studies. There are studies. I've read them back in the days when I used to do a lot more of the traffic related work. You can actually see fatalities go up as the speed limit goes up. You've seen this stuff.
Right.
And you can see it come down. I mean, you could make no freeways or capped freeways at 35 miles an hour, and you'd probably see a reduction. We've seen that exactly happen during the corona shutdowns because we saw that hospital admissions for non-corona illnesses dropped dramatically. So it is, I mean, that proves your point.
Right. But so I'm not weighing it against, you know, zero spike or small number of cases or even a great number of cases, especially of younger people who are maybe asymptomatic or who can weather the storm because they don't have pre-existing conditions or morbidly obese or over 70 or whatever it is. I'm not weighing. See, the problem is we're weighing everything against utopia. I'm not weighing opening things up against utopia. I'm weighing it against sort of a reasonable, measured amount of safety, but not ultimate safety for everyone all the time. That wasn't our agreement when we started a society. So,
well, also, yes. I'm right. It's a social contract. And by the way, there still is, you know, there's also the law of unintended consequences.
Yes.
I mean, we have just gone through, you know, I've got a number of small businesses that I'm involved in. Some I control, some I don't control. But one of the things that we tried to do across the board for all of the businesses was during the shutdown to mitigate that, to not let a lot of people go. And the reward has been, ironically, since we've opened back up, a lot of the people have now, you know, because hiring is up all of a sudden, a lot of the people who we kept on in some of these businesses have gone out and found jobs other places, which is great. More power to them. Anytime you can go make more money, I encourage you. But I will tell you now that I've got a different approach if we shut down again. If we shut down again, I'm not going to be borrowing from my IRA. I'm not going to be, you know, going through machinations for PPP and for EZILs and for the other kinds of things. I'm just going to lay everybody off. I mean, it's unfortunately been there, done that, and I'm not going to be on some kind of a yo-yo because that seems to me to be once again part of the social contract. You want to reward people for staying with you or over a number of years and seeing what happens on the other side. I mean, there's a, you can't do this repeatedly. And by the way, you can't keep printing money ad infinitum in an economy. I don't understand how they think this is going to work. I just don't. Maybe there's some economists that are smarter or have more experience than I do, but you can't just keep printing money, hope to open up, and then go shut down again. There's got to be some kind of a medium solution. You've got to be able to segregate the most vulnerable and take your chances with the rest. Otherwise, this social contract doesn't work and we are going to devolve.
Well, I think what we're experiencing is, and AOC sent the tweet out earlier in the week that kind of encapsulated what I've always kind of thought, and Bill Maher spoke about it out loud on his program several months ago. AOC has since taken down her tweet, but I don't know if it's out there, Gary, or not. Somebody sent it to me. I think Drew sent it to me. But the notion of it is worth destroying the economy to get rid of Trump. And I think that's a pretty real notion on for many Americans, especially ones that have secure jobs like AOC and Bill Maher. You know, Bill Maher and AOC are going, hey, destroy the economy. All right, well, tell that to a bunch of guys who are working paycheck to paycheck and have nothing guaranteed and no 401k. I mean, let them eat cake, so says AOC. But,
well, I have a different, that's why I love talking to you. I always get your view on it. My prism is different. I think there is and being the father of two millennials, I think there is a certain aspect where a lot of these guys really, and I say guys because it's more male oriented. I hate to be gender biased here, but I've found that the males in their 20s seem to be the ones who have embraced this. They kind of like this working at home, getting a check. And now that we've opened up, they're not too enthused about going back to work or working at all. And they kind of like this idea of not doing shit and collecting. I mean, at one point, I realized I got so mad at Jake because he was in New York, when he was in New York, he was collecting unemployment a couple of months ago. I said, well, that's not going to happen. I mean, give me a break. And he's telling me how much he's making. I said, fuck that noise. You're not going to sit there on the unemployment line. That's ridiculous. I'm going to put you to fucking work. And you're going to work. I mean, I'm not raising one of those trust fund babies. I mean, give me a break. You're not getting any inheritance. You're certainly not going to feed it the government trough. And so there is a, you know, if you keep extending out the unemployment, you keep printing the money so that there's this artificial kind of the net, so to speak, so you have no incentive to get out there and scrape, as you say. This, you don't find this phenomena amongst people who live from paycheck to paycheck. I don't see it.
Well, you know, my
By
theory,
the way, before we get yes, there, go hold ahead. On, let's tease your theory on the other All side. Right. Honey, new sponsor, at least for RD. And when I told my daughter, Teddy, about Honey, she said, Dad, you're so dense. I've been using this. It's the greatest thing ever. She shops online. She sees the promo code taunting us at the end of checkout. She knows that on Honey, you get a free browser extension. It finds automatically, they've got the way that it finds the promo code for you, automatically applies them to your card. You know what that's like? That's like when I was a kid, my mom used to cut coupons. Mm. This does it automatically. Imagine shopping on, I don't know, where do you want to go? You want to go to Macy's. Mm-hmm. You check out, the Honey button drops down. All you have to do is apply coupons, watch the prices drop. Personal endorsements. You know, I try to always have a sponsor that we use. My daughter uses this. She swears by it. There's 17 million people who use it already. Guess how much they've already saved, Adam?
17 million people. They've all $170 million. They've all
$2 billion in counting. Can you believe that? Mm. Gary, what do you say?
I say if you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free money. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/doubt. That's joinhoney.com/DOUBT.
I was thinking of something that reminded me when you're talking about your mom clipping coupons. And then I was trying to think of a joke where my mom, we were too poor to clip coupons because they didn't have coupons for scissors, and scissors were too expensive, so we never got to the part where we could actually clip the coupon. But that used to be a thing, people cutting out coupons.
I remember my mom sitting at night on the couch cutting out coupons, and then I remember her handing us S&H green stamps and blue stamps to paste into books so that we could go and get some cockamamie prize at the store.
It was always like a camping stove or something you didn't need at all.
God, that's so true.
the thing now, to be accurate, Gary's looking up this AOC quote and it looks like it was photoshopped. Although here's an interesting thing. I think the reason it resonated with Drew and he sent it to me and it resonated with me is because I think it's what she's thinking. I just think that's not. I just said I can't believe she said what she was thinking.
Yeah, it's. I think the reason it gained so much traction and why there are so many articles about it being fake is that it was just believable enough.
Oh, it's definitely what she's thinking. But my example or what I was going to offer up with was this. It's very dangerous when money becomes invisible. I've always said this. When money becomes invisible, it's real easy to throw around, you know. And you think about the relationship with, you know, my kids. They got their smartphone. They got the Apple app. And they just hit that button and they get that movie. You know, I used to go, if I wanted to see a movie, I would collect bottles from the neighborhood. Here's how old I am. I would collect bottles from the neighborhood, and I would take those bottles into a little liquor store with their redemption value, you know, a nickel for the small ones and, you know, a dime for the bigger ones. And I'd cobble together, you know, $1.50, and then I'd walk to the movie theater. And it was like an afternoon's worth of work just to go see a double feature at the Guild or the Lorena or the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood. Wow. Now, you know, my daughter, my son, they they hit buttons on apps, you know, stuff shows up at the house, Amazon signed up, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's invisible. They don't have a relationship, you know, when people were using pelts or pieces of eight or cougarons or things of that nature, like things that needed to be minted and had weight, heft, you know, I mean, just a physical relationship with coins, you know, and like counting and stuff like that. It's so much easier to think how much easier it is to leave a nice tip when you do the credit card and they go, you want to do 20% or you want to do, you just hit a button with your finger, you know. But when you used to have to go into your wallet and start peeling off bills, that's a different relationship. And I think kids are going to, we're in danger of getting a lot of people in trouble later on. I mean, think about how many kids, think about what they do with student loans. Or credit cards. You know, they show up to the college campus. Somebody's there from MasterCard. They sign up for some card that's 22%. You know, they go buy a mountain bike and go out to dinner. It's invisible. They've lost their relationship with it. When you mow lawns all summer, save up, you know, $1,100 and buy a used VW, that's a relationship with money. So we have that as our base. You know what I mean? We don't have it now, but it's our base. It's in us.
We still have it. You know why? When I have to reach, do you still carry your money on you in your pocket?
I keep it in my car, but don't. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, we shouldn't say that. You're going to encourage car burglars.
There's nothing in it.
I keep my money in my pocket. For me to peel off $100 bills as opposed to just charging it, it's a struggle. I mean,
right.
When you pay the cash, it's a struggle. You go, do I really need it? If it's a credit card, you don't think twice about it.
Right. So it's the same, but it doesn't feel the same. And
it's identical, but it doesn't feel the same.
Right. I think it's the difference between, you think about the military. Think about dropping a bomb from 40,000 feet. Or being on the ground and stabbing somebody or shooting them. You know, it's still death. It's still mayhem, but it's so much easier to do from a cockpit, right, than it is to physically do on the ground.
Or to do drone kills from some, you know, right. Like a video cockpit.
Right? Oh, right, right. So, yeah, that's easy versus what used to be difficult. So we have to kind of be careful of this very tenuous sort of bond that we have with the physicality of things and how they're going away. And the government sort of does that too. You know, think about what if you had to pay your taxes in cash, you know, quarterly, you know, you had to go down there with a pillowcase filled with $100 bills. I mean, think about how insanely this whole nation would be on fire, right?
It would be, the country would be shut down in a month. If you had to pay your taxes in cash, just think about real estate. If you had to pay your property taxes in cash, it would be over. The school systems would shut down within a month.
Right.
There's no way. You would never, can you imagine you or me in La Cañada paying our property taxes in cash? Your head would explode.
Right.
There's, I mean, you just couldn't do it.
Right. So for my kids growing up and your kids to a lesser degree, but still an impactful degree, they don't have that relationship that we grew up with. And they don't have, you know, they don't have that. You got to wash cars all day to get enough money to go out to In-N-Out Burger that night or whatever it is. And I think there's going to be consequences of that. I think there's definitely going to be consequence of that. And I had Sonny out in the yard with a pickaxe today. Like, I'm putting that dude to work because I'm trying to physically instill that in him. And he's out there. Like, it's literally like me saying, I'm rich, you're not, do push-ups. I'll give you a nickel. You can, every nickel that sticks to your nose when you pop up, you can have. But I just did that with Sonny. I also just told him, I physically looked up this morning what the California minimum wage was when I worked at McDonald's in 1980.
How much was it?
Gary, you want to guess what I got paid? I don't have to guess what I got paid. I got paid minimum wage at McDonald's in 1980.
I'm going to guess it was $4.
Kalen, guess?
I'll go with like $5.50.
$3.10. $3.10. Yeah, because it was for a long five. And taxes taken out. So you work an 8-hour shift at McDonald's. You don't even walk with $24.80. You then back out another $6.
Well, that's why back in 1975, when I was waiting tables in Pasadena, if on a weekend we could take out of there on a weekend, meaning Friday, Saturday night, $300 cash.
Oh.
That was 1975. That was like, I mean, it's like, why go to college? Why do anything? I'm going to say that's real freaking money. You can live large back then.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah, that 1975 and getting that kind of cash. Yeah, McDonald's, not so much. Minimum wage. And also, you know, we always talk about minimum wage, but it should just, I mean, I like the market-based minimum wage because I feel like I have seen the McDonald's by our house will pay you above minimum wage because they can't recruit enough of these snot-nosed rich kids to get over there and get to work for $12 an hour. They have to offer 14. And as I was noting earlier today, when I was walking down Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco a year ago, there's an In-N-Out burger that's right on the wharf. I think they're offering 17, 18 an hour because that's what it's going to take to get people to work at In-N-Out on Fisherman's Wharf. Now, not Bozeman, Montana or wherever, DeKalb, Illinois. That's a different number, but if you want them to work on the wharf, 17? I don't know. Gary can look it up.
Yeah, I believe it was somewhere in the 17, 18. But In-N-Out notoriously is just very – they pay their employees extremely well across the board. But
and they have a decent – they have got a decent service ethic there too. So I suppose there's something that relates to that.
You said you were working on a case where it's a wrongful death. Or was it a wrongful death? Is that what it is?
Yeah, wrongful death.
And
yes.
The best – example, and Mark knows this case as well, the North Hollywood bank robbers eventually were shot, the two guys. The cops claimed that they thought there was a third that was lurking around, and which is, it's not disprovable. You could think there was a third gunman in all the chaos, but they had the helicopter footage of the cops kind of hanging around and laughing and smoking and leaning against the hood of the cruiser, and they didn't appear to fear for that third gunman or fear for their own safety while the guy who they shot or who shot himself, I think he was shot by the cops, the other one shot himself, sort of bled out, and they didn't let the ambulance in, and that was a case. So, and it's a real case, and the problem is the jury instructions are probably don't worry about anything that happened before this particular moment. Just take it from that moment forward. Right. This guy's bleeding and he's a citizen. Yes.
I think that case was the son of a woman that I represented, and I represented the woman because after he died, they charged her with running some kind of a elder care center, and it was in abusive conditions in Pasadena, and the cops were, you know, in a frenzy afterwards, and so they filed on her. But as I remember, Steve Yagman, who was kind of one of the early pioneers of civil rights in what's called 1983, took that to trial, and Steve Yagman argued, and this may be apocryphal, but I love the story anyway, he argued to the jury, look, even though he had this guy had been a bank robber, even though he was wearing body armor, and even though he had taken out parts of North Hollywood, he was kind of a Chaz before there was a Chaz of North Hollywood in that particular block. You know, they still had a duty once he was down to give him aid, and showed that video of the helicopter, and obviously they didn't. And he said, just send a message to LAPD. Just award $1. $1, just so that they know they shouldn't do this. And the jury came back, and I think they gave $1. Now you would say, how does the estate and how did my client, who was the mother of this child, afford this lawyer for if he was going to trial and just trying to get $1? And what they didn't realize at the time is back then, the lawyer, if he got the $1, a positive verdict, he prevailed. He then got to submit his attorney's fees. And so then the taxpayers had to pay the attorney's fees. That's no longer the law. But back then, you could get away with that.
Jesus H. Christ. That, I've long held that mom. I mean, people talk about Michael Jackson or Scott Peterson, but the mom of that guy, and my mouth, that is your worst client of all time.
I have never gotten more grief locally in Pasadena, even when representing the mayor's wife or any of these other cases where Paulette was drummed out of the Valley Hunt Club. Nothing ever could have prevented or prepared anybody for representing the North Hollywood shooter's mother afterwards.
Oh, my God. She has to have passed. Was she like Croatian or something, or Czech or something?
There was a shit from that. I want to say Romanian, but I don't remember. I've just been well over 20 years.
All right. Let me hit the verdict with Ted Cruz. Verdict with Ted Cruz. 2020, man. Impeachment, coronavirus, race riots. Who knows what's next? Better. And who knows better than Ted Cruz? Go right to the source. Senator Ted Cruz and Michael Knowles got back together in D.C. for the first time in months, and you can listen. Verdict with Ted Cruz topped the podcast charts earlier this year with their inside look at the impeachment hearings, and now they're back. As 2020 gets even crazier, go behind the scenes in Washington, see what's really happening, and you can check out Verdict with Ted Cruz. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts and wherever you listen. Again, it is Verdict with Ted Cruz. That's Verdict with Ted Cruz. Subscribe today and say hi to Michael Knowles over there as well. Gary, when did that woman must have passed? I can't remember.
I want to say, Nick, was it Valerie? Valerie? God, it's just a... And started with an N, I think, her last name, Gary.
I believe the gentleman in question's last name is Matt the Swerno or something like that. I believe it's an M like Mary.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people don't first name.
People don't know that the movie
his first
Heat
name is
was based on that scene. Yeah. You know, the movie, the big movie Heat. Yeah, sorry. His name?
His first name is if you were to pronounce it like the English spelling, it's Decibel. Decibel Stefan Emilion, but he went by Emil. And the other other gentleman.
What was Emil's mother? Put Emil mother Garrigus in. See if I can get the client's name.
All right, let me give some plugs while Gary's looking that up. We're doing live shows. That is this coming Friday and Saturday, Tempe Improv. So come on out and say hi. We're doing stand up and live podcasts there. Dallas coming up July 24th, 25th, Addison Improv. Go to amcarolla.com for all the live shows. And get my book. I'm your emotional support animal, Navigating Our All Woke No Joke Culture. It's funny and it's good. Sorry. Yes, Gary.
All right, Mark. So you were right, and I corrected you on accident. Valerie Nikolursky Mantisano.
Yeah, there
so
you
she
go.
Had a
okay.
hyphenated last name that did start with an N like go. Nancy, and then the last part of her last name was what her son bore.
Oh, well,
I don't remember what the result was. I wish I could remember what happened with her case.
Well, you got her bail reduced. That's where I found her name, is in an LA Times article about you getting her bail reduced.
Right. I wonder what happened. I know. I remember getting her out. I remember at the time, back then, Sybil Brand was the women's jail down off the 10 freeway. And she was on kind of the murderer's row of Sybil Brand back then. And at that time, it was one of the strangest times of my career. I actually represented four women who were at Sybil Brand who were all charged with murder. And Valerie was on that same row, and Susan McDougal. Talk about a range of women. So Valerie was there. Susan McDougal was there, Bill Clinton's ex-business partner. And four women who I represented who were all charged with murder, which I have never seen before or since. But was a interesting place. They closed that place down because it was such a hellhole, that woman's jail. But it was kind of an interesting time in that career.
From all the jail movies I've seen from the 80s, they should rename it Sybil Danning Prison. You guys can Google that shit and thank me later. Mark, you got plugs?
I do. The V Palm Springs, go down there. You may see Jake this weekend. I won't say why. Say hi if he's there. You might go to the, if you're in the Hamptons, go by the Naya, which is the restaurant. We got a pop-up there, which is great. And you've got the Capri Hotel. You've got Casa Tropicana in San Clemente, which is new and refurbished. And 10E Mediterranean Tapas, we're back open, as is Engine Company 28.
So, till next time, Adam Kroll for Mark Garagos saying, mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode. This is Corolla Digital.